Okay, so the first of these sutras is called Future Parallelism. And this is a continuation of the theme I was talking about yesterday. I was mentioning yesterday how important I think it is to actually go back to the word of the Buddha. Because the word of the Buddha is the foundation of all of Buddhism. Because the word of the Buddha, if there's anything which is Buddhism, it surely is the word of the Buddha, which is the Buddhist teachings. And that's why it's so important. And here is a short discourse where the Buddha actually, Buddha himself talks about the dangers of the future. And this kind of supports this idea of going back to the earliest teachings and to understand the source where all these things come from. So I'm going to read this out and then I will discuss the various points that come up here as I go through these things. So, future perils. This is from the discourse called the Anguttara Nikaya, which means the numerical discourses. And this is how it goes. Bhikkhus is monks. So monks, there are these five future perils. Perils like a danger, right? Five future dangers as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. You should recognize them and make an effort to abandon them. What are these five? And this is the fourth one that I've picked out because this is the one that is most important for our purposes today. And he says here, again, in the future, there will be monks who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. When those discourses, those suttas, those texts spoken by the Tathagata, Tathagata is the Buddha, are being recited that are deep, deep in meaning, world transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, to lend an ear to them, and to apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited, that are mere poetry composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They will think those teachings should be studied and learned. Thus, because through the corruption of the Dhamma comes corruption of the discipline, and from the corruption of the discipline comes the corruption of the Dhamma. This is the fourth future peril as yet unarisen that will arise in the future. You should recognize it and make an effort to abandon it. So here the Buddha is saying is that, what he's saying here basically is that the foundation of one's practice as a Buddhist, or even if you just have an interest in the Buddha's teachings, the foundation is always the word of the Buddha. It doesn't mean that you cannot listen to anything else, it doesn't mean you cannot have another teaching, but the foundation stone, the thing which is kind of the measure, the gold standard, if you like, of what Buddhism is all about, is always the word of the Buddha. And the amazing thing is that we still have the word of the Buddha. Even now, after 2,500 or 2,400 years or whatever it is, we still have the word of the Buddha. It's still there. And we know with a fair degree of certainty what that word of the Buddha is. So because of that, we should use it. We should take that as the kind of the basis upon which the practice is done. And when you do that, that is when you get you're most likely to get really, really good results in the meditation practice. And not only the meditation, but your whole life, right? The purpose of the Dhamma, the purpose of Buddhism, is not just about meditation. It's about a transformation of your entire life. It's about changing your character, but looking at the world in a new way. It's about understanding things in a new light, a way you haven't done before. It's a complete transformation. But it's like a good transformation, right? It's a bit like, imagine yourself on the worst possible day. You wake up in the morning, you feel really grumpy and bad, right? And then another day, you feel really happy, and you feel really joyful, and everything is just so easy. We all know what that is, right? Some days are good, some days are bad. So after a while, you have more of the good days and less of the bad days. And then the good days become even better, right? And the bad days are like the good days were before. And then in this way, things start to rise, and you lift yourself up, and things become better and better in this way. And this is what it's like. This is what I mean by transforming your character and transforming your personality. It's like your habits, your entire sense of person starts to change. Anyway, this is the purpose of this path, and this is done by anchoring yourself, by having a place of. This is what we mean by the idea of going for refuge, right? Going for refuge to the Dhamma. The idea of refuge is the idea that you have a place you can go, a place where you can get some good advice, a place where you can understand the world, a place where you can, if you have a question, you can go there and you can ask the question and get a good response to what the question is all about. This is what the idea of refuge is all about. And we need to know where to place that refuge, not to place it in the wrong place. And the place then is the discourses of the Tathagata, the Buddha, that are deep, deep in meaning, right? It's not just a superficial deepness. Sometimes you read a kind of verse and you think, wow, that sounds really profound. But then when you think about it, actually, maybe it isn't that profound after all. And then there are other things that may sound very superficial. They may not sound all that profound, but actually they are very deep and very. There's a lot more to them than actually you might think to start off with. So that ability, that this is one of the things that we need to do. We need to be careful about the things that just sound fancy, fancy words. What is that? There was one famous. I'm sure you heard about this famous teacher called. What is he called? Osho, is that what he called himself?
Yeah. Osho,
yeah. And he was he's one of those very charismatic teachers. But I think today he's widely recognized as being a bit of a fraud and a bit of a very highly dodgy character. You know, he had about 10 Rolls Royces and all this kind of stuff, and he was supposed to be a spiritual teacher. And I think he was very good with words, right? He was a wordsmith, and he put things together in such a way people sort of, wow, this is this really profound stuff. And he said, I think one point he said something like that, I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. That was one of his sayings. And when you hear that, you think, ooh, that sounds really profound. But actually, when you think about it, it's quite empty. It's just words. It doesn't really say anything. Because detachment, by its very nature, is to be detached. And it doesn't really mean that much. So this is the thing, is the idea of being able to understand, to distinguish between those things that really are profound. And this is the point of the word of the Buddha. It may seem simple, it may seem basic. The Buddha says, when you speak, speak kind words. When you say things, speak things that unite people, bring people together. Don't speak harsh words, speak gentle words and beautiful words. And these things are very simple teachings, but they're very profound, because if you take them to heart and you practice these things, they can really transform you. I noticed that. I've just been back to Norway. That's where my family lives. And I've just been back visiting my parents. And it's amazing how that relationship with my parents has been transformed after I became a monk. It's just absolutely astonishing. How initially they thought I was like the black sheep of the family becoming a monk, right? Really, really bad. How can you become a monk? Did we bring you up for this? No, we brought you up for something else, something meaningful and purposeful. But after a while, because you live the monastic life well, because you do things to the best of your ability, you don't push your ideas onto other people, you just live them instead. Slowly, slowly, things come around and things start to change. And you start to treat your parents much better than before. You grow up, you're young, like all people, you have to rebel a bit against your parents and all these kind of things. But after a while, you do very simple things, just like speaking in a gentle way, speaking in a way which is meaningful. And these little simple things, they have an incredibly powerful, transformative effect on yourself and also on the people around you. This is just to show you the power of the teachings of the Buddha. They are actually, in my mind, extremely simple. Not always simple, but often simple and very, very powerful. So they are deep, deep in meaning, not just superficially deep, but actually deep. They are world transcending, right? They actually take you out of the ordinary world, they take you to something more profound, something which is outside of our ordinary experience. This is part of what this is about. And they are, last of all, connected with emptiness. And this is the thing which is the most telling, in a sense, the thing which makes the Buddha's teaching different from almost all other spiritual teachings is the idea of emptiness. The idea of emptiness is this idea that when you start learning about yourself, what you don't actually find anything substantial inside of yourself. And this is kind of the most profound aspect of the Buddha's teachings. is what we mean by this non-self idea, which may, perhaps we can talk about later on, the idea of emptiness, a very profound teaching in the Buddhist teachings. I'm not going to go into that at the moment. So when you hear these things that are really great, you're not really interested. You think, yeah, the word of the Buddha, you know, I don't really want to read that, it's boring, it comes from 2,500 years, it's different culture, different time, all these kind of things. And because of that, you don't make the effort to actually try to understand these powerful teachings. So I recommend you, if you have an interest in the Buddhist teachings, and you want to supplement your meditation practice with other things which actually uphold the meditation, try to read some suttas and see if you can find that inspiration in the word of the Buddha. It is extraordinarily powerful in my experience. And instead of listening to those things, instead of being interested in that, you tend to, you know, instead people have this tendency to listen to the poets, right? You can see why, you know, poetry, beautiful words and phrases, you read a piece of poetry, it is very nice, very pleasing because it's nice. And this is because the human mind is such that we tend to go towards gratification right there and then. So beautiful phrase, beautiful poetry, because it's beautiful in its own right, whether it's deep or not doesn't really matter. That's where the mind tends to go. So be careful of that. Be careful of always leaning towards what is beautiful rather than what is truly meaningful. Because that is the tendency we have. And sometimes you have to go against your tendencies. If you don't go against your tendencies, you're never going to go very far on the spiritual path. So this is the first thing. So watch out for just the beautiful stuff. The other thing is what is created by the outsiders. And this means that instead of focusing on the teachings of Buddhism, you focus on Osho, right? Osho, the not even being attached to detachment, right? That kind of stuff. So as a one of the things about taking refuge in Buddhism is the fact that that's where you find the basic inspiration in your practice. You don't find it in other places. So that is part of what this is about. Spoken by disciples. This is, to me, perhaps the most interesting thing here. And this is one of the reasons why I like to read out this sutta. And this is the idea. If you look around the Buddhist world today, certainly, this is true everywhere. It's true in the traditional Buddhist countries of Asia, Thailand, China, Sri Lanka, wherever you go. It's also very common in the West in these days. And that is the problem that almost everybody, they listen to people who are disciples of the Buddha. They listen to teachers, right? My teacher in Australia, Ajahn Brahm, if I just listened to Ajahn Brahm all the time, that would mean that I would be listening to a disciple, right? Or people that listen to Ajahn Chah, right? They listen to Ajahn Sumedho. They listen to a Zen master here, a Burmese Sayadaw there. They listen to all these other, they have all these other people who they take as their teachers. And I've always been quite baffled. Do you ever hear anybody who says, the Buddha is my teacher? Nobody ever says that, right? They have this teacher, that teacher. Very few people ever say that the Buddha is their teacher. But I try to say that. I try to say that the Buddha is my teacher. Yes, you can have other teachers as well. It's not an absolute dichotomy, one or the other. You can have both. But in the end, it is the Buddha who is our teacher. And why is that? It's because all these other teachers, the reason why they have any authority, the reason why they have the right to teach in the first place, the reason why I'm wearing this these kind of brown robes or whatever, the reason why I shave my hair, all of that goes back to the Buddha. I gain my authority as a teacher because I'm a Buddhist monk, right? I gain the authority because I'm a disciple of the Buddha. Everybody gains their authority because they are ultimately disciples of the Buddha. Now, if you gain your authority from that, then you also should honor that by giving those teachings that the Buddha taught in the first place. Otherwise, it's like being a bit fraudulent, especially if you teach things that are contrary to the Buddha's teachings. It's actually being very fraudulent in that case. So because of that, because my authority comes from being a disciple of the Buddha, to me it's an obligation to teach the teachings of the Buddha. This should be the primary thing. So I'm not saying here that there's either one that you have to just listen to the Buddha, nobody else. I'm just saying that both things can go together here. But the main thing, the priority, the thing which we always come back to should be the teachings of the Buddha himself. And that is a very revolutionary way of thinking about things, and particularly in countries like Thailand, where everybody has a teacher and nobody really knows anything about the words of the Buddha. It's kind of a revolution in consciousness to actually think that you should read the suttas. In many Asian countries, what you find, you go to the monastery and you find the suttas, and the suttas are kind of put up very high, right, in this kind of beautiful little kind of cupboard, and the suttas are behind glass doors and they are locked so nobody can get access to them. And then you come in and you bow down to the suttas, and you bow down three times and you worship the suttas. That's what you do. But nobody reads them, right? So they become an object of worship instead of an object of through which you actually gain understanding about the Buddha's teachings. And that is a shame. Of course, you should respect these things, but they're not objects of worship as such. They have no power as objects of worship. The power is in the content of the word, the meaning of what they say. That's where the power is. And then they are incredibly powerful, as far as I can see. Okay, so that is the word of the Buddha compared to the word of other people and outsiders, etc. And that is what happens when there is a corruption, he says here, the corruption of the Dhamma comes through the corruption of the discipline, the corruption of the discipline comes through the corruption of the Dhamma. So what this means is that the corruption of the Dhamma comes through the corruption. So the idea here is that if the Dhamma is wrong, the teaching is wrong, then the discipline here, I don't like the word discipline, the word here is vinaya. The word vinaya actually in the early suttas means something like training. So we have the Dhamma on the one hand, the Dhamma is like the teaching. And then the consequence of the teaching is that you practice in a certain way. And that is the vinaya, the consequence of the teaching. Because the whole practice, part of that are the precepts and all these kind of things. But in a broader context, it means everything we do. So the teachings are wrong, then the practice starts to become bad, right? And of course, if you practice wrong there, that means you can't really realize those teachings. You don't understand what they're about. Because you don't understand what they're about, you start to teach wrongly. So these two things go together. And this is what the meaning of this last phrase actually is. So that is what this is saying. I should maybe also say very briefly at the very top there, it says slightly cryptically, undeveloped in body, virtue, mind, and wisdom. So again, the problem here is that because you are not developed, because you haven't developed your wisdom, you haven't developed your mind. All of these things are about developing the path. Because you haven't developed that, you don't really understand the teachings. Because you don't understand the teachings, you lean in a different direction and you take on board things which aren't really that important. And what this shows you, it shows you the incredible importance of having people in this world that are well practiced, right? People ideally who are what we call in our tradition the Aryas. Aryas means people who have realized the Dhamma, understood what it's all about. Because these are the people who will understand the power of the teachings of the Buddha. These are the people who carry the teaching forward. So actually it's very, very, very important to have these Aryas, these enlightened beings in the world who understand the teachings fully. Okay, so that is why the teachings of the Buddha are so important, and why these provide the foundation stone for all practice of Buddhism. If you have any questions about any of these things, I'm sure many of you will have questions, because there's a lot of things that I cover when I talk about these things. So please write those down wherever Richard has placed the basket or whatever it is. So that is the starting point. Now let us see what the Buddha has to say. And this next sutta here is about meditation practice and how the meditation practice, this is one way of regarding meditation and how meditation was taught by the Buddha himself. So again, I will do what I did just before. I will read this out and then I will explain what is going on here, because it is probably not going to be all that obvious. Sutta is called Volition. And volition means basically like the will, right? It's the will of the mind, the doer in the mind, what volition is all about. months. For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no will, no desire basically, no will, no doing needs to be exerted. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no will, no desire needs to be exerted. Let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no will, no intention, no desire needs to be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. Excuse me. For one with a rapturous mind, no will. Rapture means like, it's a bit like joy, it's a bit more powerful than joy. Rapture is often like the physical feeling of joy in the body and this kind of thing. That's what rapture means. This is just another word for joy, basically. No volition needs, no will or desire needs to be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no will, no doing needs to be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no will needs to be exerted. Let my mind be concentrated. This is a bad word according to some. Let us use the word still instead. Let my mind be still. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is still. For one who is still, no will needs to be exerted. Let me know and see things according to reality. It is natural that one who is still knows and sees things according to reality. So there you are. This is the one of the ways. The Buddha explains meditation in many different ways. And this is one of these explanations of meditation practice. There's different kind of approaches to explaining meditation. There's one approach of explaining meditation is what we're supposed to do, right? How we're supposed to apply ourselves. It's what we are, in other words, it gives you a sequence of things on how to look at the world, how to understand things, how to apply the mind in the right way. This is the doing part of the meditation, what we actually need to focus on. That is one way. That's, of course, a very important part of how to do the meditation practice. But another way of explaining meditation, that is what we're seeing here, is to understand what happens inside of you as you meditate. What is the process? What is the psychology that goes on inside of you as the meditation progresses? So this particular sequence here can be understood in a sense as the psychology of meditation. In other words, what does meditation feel like? Or what should it feel like when it actually works? So this is what we're seeing here. This is the psychology, right? So why is that useful? It's useful because it gives you a guide, it gives you signposts on the way. It tells you whether you're heading in the right direction. This is what this is about. It gives you this, it's like when you want to go from Helsinki to Turku. You know, you have like signs on the way saying, you know, 100 kilometers, how far is it to Turku? I don't know how far it is, but 100 kilometers, 50 kilometers, as you get closer and closer. And you know you're heading in the right direction. And this is the same thing here. This is a signpost. It's like saying, okay, now you are at, you know, you're getting rapture, you're getting tranquility in body. So these are the signposts of meditation. And this is the way you know that when you're meditating, that you're heading in the right way. You know that it actually is working. So this is very useful. This kind of psychology of meditation is very useful because it tells you whether you're actually doing the right thing. So this is like a map, right? A map telling you, or a description of the terrain, so to speak. So what is this map like? Now one of the interesting things about this is that you will see in this particular list, I was saying before today, that meditation is all about well-being, you know, feeling good about feeling good, basically feeling relaxed, feeling at ease. Now, if you look at that list, one of the things that stand out about this list is how much there is about happiness in there, how much there is about joy, how much there is about feeling good. You know, you have the joy arising. Yeah. So joy is like when you feel glad, right? You feel a sense of gladness inside, you feel light, you feel easy. Yeah. From joy comes rapture. Rapture is even more joy. Yeah. That's like when sometimes you feel the physical feeling of rapture in the body. And many of you may have felt that in meditation before, yeah, when it's almost like you feel an energy flow in the body. Yeah. And this energy going through, which is a very kind of pleasant kind of energy, that is often what we call, that is what is the meaning of rapture here. Yeah. But probably what is piti, and it's described in this way as a flow of energy, a kind of feeling going through the body, very pleasant, but still fairly coarse, but very pleasant anyway. Yeah. And then comes the tranquility, right? You continue the practice, you continue watching the breath or whatever, and you go through these stages as you're watching the breath. And then you come to tranquility. In other words, you start to feel peaceful there. Everything becomes nice and easy here. The mind settles down. There's no restlessness anymore. There's no feeling that you want to be anywhere else. You want to be just right here. Why? Because the present moment becomes the pleasant moment. It's a nice way of thinking about it. The present moment is the pleasant moment. So you become nice and peaceful and you just want to stay right here. Everything is tranquil. No restlessness anymore here. And then from that comes even more happiness, it says here. Because that is an even more profound sense of happiness. Right? From that comes stillness. This is the samadhi. Stillness means the mind is very peaceful. So everything here is about happiness. It even starts off at the very beginning. It says that there will be no regret for a person who is virtuous. No regret is also happiness, right? If you're having regret, it's not nice to have regret about something you have done. You feel a sense of conscience perhaps, or you don't feel happy about your conduct. That's kind of unpleasant. If you have no regret, that's another way of understanding, of seeing how happiness is part of the path here. So this is the amazing thing about, because I was saying yesterday to you that, you know, it's all about being happy. And here it is, black on white. Here it's, you know, here it's very, very clear from the Buddha's teachings that this is what meditation should feel like. It should feel happy, at ease. It should be something positive, a positive experience all the way. Now, for you, it is very hard to evaluate whether this is an important text or not, whether this is actually, you know, one of the foundation texts in Buddhism. How important is it? Maybe I have chosen like a very text which is kind of found in a corner somewhere in Tipitaka, a really dodgy one which nobody reads, right? But this is possible to do because the sutta and the discourse of the Buddha are very live, and you can find texts that are more obscure, and you can find more like mainstream texts that are kind of taught again and again. And this is an important principle. If you want to read the suttas, one way to decide whether something is really important in these suttas is to see how often they are taught. So if you see a text which is taught by the Buddha again and again and again, in different places, to different people, in different circumstances, both to monks and to lay people, and to nuns, and to, you know, monks, and everything, then you can be pretty sure this is a foundational teaching of Buddhism. This is one way of deciding whether something is really important or not. And it's a very useful way of evaluating this teaching, because sometimes people make a lot out of a very obscure teaching, yeah, and they say, oh, this, look at this teaching, this is really interesting, but actually it's not really interesting because it's just too obscure and too unknown. But the best thing to do is to stick to those teachings that you find again and again, and this teaching is one of those. One of those teachings that you find in so many places in the suttas, the same structure, this idea of, this is like dependent arising, one thing arising in dependence on something else. It's not really what we normally call dependent origination, but it is a similar kind of structure to dependent arising. You can call it dependent liberation if you like, because it's how liberation comes about, dependent on causes. So this is a foundational text, it's a very important one. And this is one of the reasons why I like to read it out. And this is why this idea of happiness on the path is so important. And why you should use this. Whenever you go on a meditation retreat, whenever you meditate for yourself, either through a single meditation or as a way of looking at your general progress of meditation throughout your life, both of those should be a movement towards more ease, more happiness, and all these things. So that is the first thing there, which is very important in this. And I can, this is one of the things, when you read this for yourself, you might not get all these things out of this text, right? And this is one of the advantages of having studied these things for 20 years, is that you start to see some of the depth in these things. And that is one of the great things about being a teacher. You can point out things to people that otherwise they might not be able to see. And the second thing which is very interesting here, and that is the fact that it says all the way through, it says no volition need be exerted. And this word volition is just a fancy word for saying that no willpower. You don't need to do anything. That's basically what it means. You don't have to exert yourself. You don't need to act. You don't need to have any intention. You don't need to decide how this is going to happen. It happens all by itself. It arises, as it says here, it is natural. This, the word natural is, in Pali, dhammika? Not dhammika. Something based on the word dhamma. The word dhamma is nature in Pali, or in Sanskrit language. So it is natural, it happens according to the way things are. And if you put these things into place, the next thing will happen as a consequence. Right? That tells you, this is what I was saying before about when you meditate. Don't use any will, right? Don't use any power, don't force yourself in any way. Allow things to be here. Learn to be a passive observer. Because willpower, the will is not going to get you anywhere. It is a meditation is a natural process. It happens by itself. And it happens when the willpower gets out of the way. And that's why the idea of learning to be a passive observer is so powerful. When you're a passive observer, when you accept everything as it is, it means acceptance is the opposite of will, right? If you don't accept things, then you want to change it. But if you accept, it means you don't want to change things. If you don't want to change things, the will is redundant. The will isn't important anymore. That's why acceptance is so important. So when you accept everything, there was quite a bit of noise coming from the doors there towards the end of the meditation, right? So how do you react to that? Do you react by getting, all this noise, you know, shouldn't be there, this is bad, this is not good for the meditation? Or do you just say, this is, life is like this. There's always going to be noise when I don't want it. There's always going to be problems when I don't want these things. I can't control this. Because I can't control it, I'm just going to accept it, whatever is there. And then you have acceptance towards the noise. And in this way, by learning how to accept, you're learning how to, it's like you're withdrawing the will, you're withdrawing the doer from your mind, from the world, and you're just accepting things as they are. And when you do that, things start to calm down. They calm down because the willpower, the doing was the thing which created the disturbance in the first place. The disturbance is there because of the will. So by withdrawing the will, things start to calm down. And then you are allowing this process to happen by itself. Right? So it says here that, the way it is said here, it says that no will needs to be exerted. The Pali, what it actually says, it says that this cannot be done through will. That's what the Pali says. It's not just the fact that it need not be exerted. It says it cannot be done through will. This sequence, you don't feel happiness because you want to feel happy, right? I mean, I'm sure we all try that. I want to feel happy, and you're going to grit your teeth and try to be happy. It's not going to work, right? Happiness just arises. Some days you feel happy, some days you don't feel happy, and so often you can't really figure out why. It's kind of this mysterious thing. And willpower is not going to change it. If willpower could change it, we would be happy all the time. But we're not happy all the time. So willpower gets in the way of this process. It is a natural thing. And isn't that beautiful? Isn't that a nice thing that all you have to do is relax? All you have to do is sit back? All you have to do is to be patient. And if you are patient enough, all of these things start to happen on their own accord. It's a very beautiful path. A path which is very easy, right? You can just breathe naturally, be at ease, and these things come about as a consequence. So that is the that is that aspect of this sutta. The thing that these things are all natural. Now, the perhaps the last thing I can talk about, and this is If it is a natural process, then what is it that we have to do? Does it mean that we don't have to do anything? What exactly do we have to do if the path is natural? And because this is a conditioned sequence, because all of these things happen as a natural consequence, dependent on the previous thing, then of course the most important thing in the sequence is the first one, right? Everything else happens as a consequence. The first one is what really matters, because the first one is what then drives the rest of the sequence. Right? You can probably see what I'm getting at. And the first one is what? The first one is virtue. It's morality. It's the quality of your heart, the quality of your mind, the quality of your habits. That is what really matters. So if you want meditation to work, it's not about willpower, it's about virtue. It's about who you are as a person. That is what really matters. So if you are, the more ability you have to live a life of kindness, a life of non-harming, a life of even of renouncing things, a life where you have compassion for other beings, where you, generally speaking, you know, it's not always going to work out. Sometimes, some days, you're not going to feel compassionate. That's just the way things are. But generally speaking, you move in that direction. And the more you can do that, the more powerful your meditation is going to be. That is what this means. So think about that. If your meditation, you will find out on this retreat how good your meditation is. And you will find out sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not so good, sometimes it's really, really bad, right? That's just the way things are. But then ask yourself, what can I do in my daily life to actually improve, to make sure that next time I come on a retreat, my meditation will be more powerful? What can I do? And here you see, again, this integration of virtue and meditation, how important they are to go together. Meditation on its own, without the aspect of living a virtuous life, doesn't really, it can still be nice, it can still be useful to some extent, but the real meditation practice only happens as a consequence of integrating it with living a good life, being a good person, integrating it with having a good heart in your daily existence. That's when it becomes really powerful. So I recommend, this is why, this is why I always recommend reading the suttas, because it gives you a much broader picture of what the practice is about. Very often, in the Western world specifically, you find that meditation is divorced from everything else, and all you're taught is meditation practice. But if you really want to transform yourself, if you really want a better life, if you want to improve the quality of your life, you need to have a broader outlook than just thinking about meditation by itself. That is the virtue, and there's lots of things that can be said for virtue. Maybe I can talk for just a few minutes more about virtue before we continue the meditation afterwards. One of the things about Buddhist things about virtue is that virtue, usually in the English language, or morality, very often focuses on the negative aspect of things, right? Don't do A, don't do B, don't do C, because these are bad things to do. This is kind of the standard way. The word morality is to focus on the negative things. But in Buddhism, the idea of virtue, the word behind this is the word sila. And the word sila means something, means much more than that. It means habit. It means character. It means who you are as a person. Right? So the idea here is not just that you don't do the bad things, you do the good things. You have compassion. You help other people. You are generous. You speak with kind words. You speak in a way that unites people, bring people together. You don't gossip too much. And so that is also the positive side of things, which is very important in Buddhism. So that is one thing about virtue. The second thing about Buddhist virtue, which makes it much more profound than any other kind of virtue, is the fact that it also includes the mind. It includes how you think, right? So what is your mind like? Is your mind, do you have mind states that are generally positive, that are wholesome, that you have metta, you have loving kindness and compassion for other people? Or have you a tendency towards anger and irritation, all these kinds of things? Do you have a mind which is often obsessed by desires and attachments in this world? Or you have a mind which is much more free from those things? Do you have a lot of confusion in your mind? Or do you have clarity? Do you have restlessness, or do you have peace? Do you have doubt, or do you have a sense of clarity about what is good and what is bad. And all of these things are the areas where the mental factor is also important. And one of the factors, the mental factor that the Buddha mentioned specifically, is also the factor of right view. Right view is also one of the factors that is part of this idea of sila, of virtue in Buddhism. It doesn't sound like it, right? It doesn't sound like a right view should be virtue, but actually it is. And the reason for that is because when you look at the world in a certain way, it supports your practice. But if you look at the world in the wrong way or a different way, it doesn't support the practice. And the way to look at the world in the right way is the way that the world actually is. You want to align your understanding of the world with the way the world actually is. This is the point. Right? And to understand that, it's a very simple principle, but it's like if you want to do anything in life, if you have the wrong information about something, if you think that A is B and B is A, or black is white and white is black, whatever, if you have the complete wrong information about something, you can't act in the right way. You can't act based on proper information. You know, I like to use a very kind of very banal example of the stock market. You want to invest in the stock market, right? So you have a bit of money extra, maybe you inherited something, you think, oh, what can I do with this money? So you invest it on the stock market. Now, either you can have really bad information about the stock market, terrible, you have a stockbroker who hasn't got a clue what's going on, and it gives you completely the wrong information, and then you invest, and you know, 2 months later you lost all your money because of that. That's like wrong view, right? You don't really understand what's going on. You don't have enough information about this company, whatever it is. Or the opposite is having insider information, right? So you have the insider information, you know something nobody else knows. And then that is right view. It's of course it's illegal to use it. So I'm not saying you should. This is just an example. It's not a suggestion. But the point is that because you have inside information, it means you know something nobody else knows. You have right view about this company. You know what's going on. And of course, if you invest, then you will make money because of that right view. So, and this is true in all of life, right? Whenever you have right view, you can act appropriately, you can act in the right way. If you know where the shop is, you can walk straight to the shop. If you don't know where it is, well, you can't walk. You're very likely to walk in the wrong direction. And it's exactly the same thing in the spiritual life. If you have right understanding of the world, right understanding of what things actually are like, then you can guide your spiritual life according to that view. And then that spiritual mind becomes much more powerful as a consequence. So for this reason, right view, right understanding things according to reality is actually quite important on the Buddhist path. And this is also part of virtue. And of course, the way the Buddha described right view, and this is things like rebirth, right? The idea of rebirth and karma is part of this this thing here. And sometimes people find it challenging, this idea of rebirth. They think, what? Rebirth? I don't want to hear about rebirth. And what I say to people, if you find the idea of rebirth to be challenging, then that's okay. You're not supposed to force yourself to believe in these things. But if you find it challenging, at least try to have an open mind about it. At least try to think about it. Try to reflect on it and see if it makes any sense to you. And if you find out that at the end of the day you have to reject it, so be it. That's okay. You can't lie to yourself. You have to be true to yourself. But if you do reflect on it and you find that it starts to make sense, that of course is also good from a Buddhist point of view. And I remember that there's one of the Anagarikas. Anagarikas are one of the people in training at the monastery. And one of our Anagarikas in Perth, he's a Kiwi, just like John over here. And a very nice fellow. And he said that he started off in Buddhism. He thought this idea of rebirth was absolute rubbish, and he was kind of a hardcore atheist, kind of a secular Buddhist, and he didn't want to have anything to do with these things that he considered to be superstition initially. But after a while, when he started to think about these things, after a while, when he started to reflect on the meaning, reading the suttas, and seeing what this actually was all about, often it's just because you're not really used to the idea, it sounds foreign and strange. Because you're not used to the idea, there's something inside of you which blocks you from accepting it. But he said after a while he changed his mind completely. because the he thought the idea actually makes incredibly good sense after all that. So this is the part of the challenge here, is the challenge of right view. That's also part of virtue. So this is the area that we need to focus on, this idea of being kind, being good, having a good heart, and even the idea of right view. And these things will then become supports for your meditation practice. If you can focus on that in your ordinary life, then when you come back on the meditation retreat next time, you find that something has changed. Your mindfulness is more powerful. Your presence of mind is more strong. You feel more, it's easy to focus on your meditation object. And this is true for my life. I've been a Buddhist monk now for 20 years. And the reason I'm still a Buddhist monk is precisely for that reason, because I can see a gradual improvement, right? I can see a gradually the mindfulness becoming more strong. Gradually you become more kind and compassionate. Gradually you become more peaceful in your daily life. And this is what sustains me on the Buddhist path. The suttas promise you this is what happens. And if it then happens, then you get a lot of confidence in the suttas. If it doesn't happen, then eventually you think, why am I wearing these robes? These are just a hassle to wear these robes. You know, wearing like a skirt or whatever it is. And you have to shave your head. Why am I wearing these things if I don't actually make any progress? It doesn't make any sense. But then when you see it actually works, it gives you so much confidence in these teachings. And it all becomes very powerful. This is how meditation then works according to the suttas. And the very last factor of this sequence here is the factor of seeing things in accordance with reality. And this is what we're trying to do on the Buddhist path. It is true, of course, you start off with right view, right understanding of what the world is like. But ultimately, you want to see these things for yourself. You want to have a direct insight into these teachings. And this is one of the great things that the Buddhism promises you. It promises you a path, direct understanding for yourself. Buddhism is not ultimately a faith. You know, most religions are faith. I believe in God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, or whatever. I can't even remember how you say these things anymore. But that's not Buddhism. Buddhism, yes, there is a degree of confidence and faith initially, but the purpose is actually to see things for yourself. That is the whole point of the Buddhist teachings. And that is where this leads. So happiness leads to insight. And of course, insight is even more happiness. This is what I was saying yesterday. In Buddhism, it's all about happiness leading to happiness and not pain leading to happiness. So this is where we are heading. And this is hopefully gives you some understanding of how we actually get there. Okay, so that is, I think that's enough for now.